off, this subsidy off. But let's look at this principle. A barrel of oil has 149 liters. Right now, 1 liter of oil in Nigeria is $1, which values a barrel at $149. If you go on NASDAQ or wherever you're going to check it, a barrel of oil is not $149. So how is it that you're almost $60 above what they're selling the crude oil, not the derivative, the petroleum, the kerosene, the diesel? So it makes no sense, you know? And then you have the IMF and all these the IMF, the World Bank, who I think are demons, and who have literally undermined my country. Because what they have done is they take these large sums of money and they give to leadership, knowing fully well that these are corrupt leaders who are going to take this money and not do anything with it. The money does not get to the people. I'll give you a great example. As of last year, the IMF and the World Bank, along with China, Russia, and some other companies who have an interest in Nigeria, are going to be lending Nigeria over $3 billion. Now, let me give you a quick breakdown of a couple things. In Nigeria, the president of Nigeria has 173 personal assistants. Check this out. The presidential palace has been earmarked for food alone, for food, $6.5 million. He has been earmarked $750,000 for fuel for his generators. Now, how do you want me to buy into your energy program when you're spending $750,000? It makes no sense. There's no social security. There's no health care. I mean, it's out of control. And we're not going to stand for it.
Nigeria has a rich history of revolt and rebellion against transnational oil companies, right?
Yes, yes.
Can you describe maybe a little bit of that history and how what we're seeing right now is a part of that, either similarities with Nigeria's rebellious history or differences?
Okay. I happen to be from the Delta region, and I sympathize with the armed rebellion against these things because it was just really incredible what was happening. And so people took up arms and said, you know what, we're going to take it ourselves. And so what happened was they first tried to quell them by using the government forces to, you know, beat them down. But these people, they know the land. They use the land to their advantage, and it was impossible for you to ship out. And so what they did is they came up with an amnesty program where you give up your guns and agree to not jeopardize these holdings, and they give you a stipend. And so they're actually having the Nigerian budget where they have something for the amnesty of these things. But what is going on right now is that stipend is not going to stop people from realizing a better life. You got to realize that most of the Nigerians who came to America in the 70s and 60s came to America because it was cheaper to go to school and live in America than it was in Nigeria. But since the World Bank and the IMF have given us these loans and these interest rates, it has devalued our money. Up to 1979, it was 50 cents of our money to one American dollar. Now it's one American dollar to 162 naira. We're very nonviolent people to start off with. But I'm saying this, we're going to fight.
And that was John Neffel at the Nigerian consulate. We won't be with you tomorrow night. Our show is being preempted by a special with Tavis Smiley and Cornel West. Please tune in for that. We'll be with you again on Friday night. Stay tuned.
And the time is 7 o'clock. You're listening to radio station WBAI New York. And that means it's time for Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse. Best expect the worst.
And good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you. Joined tonight by Mike.
Good evening.
And over there is Red Hacked, I believe.
Hello.
That's Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Over there is Jim.
Hi.
And down to the south a little bit, Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia.
And joining us in the studio tonight, a very esteemed special guest, Mitch Altman.
Hello.
Well, now, you're just back from or on your way to what exactly? You're always moving someplace.
Yeah, I get to move around a lot. I'm coming back slowly home from Berlin, where I was there for Chaos Congress.
Wait a minute. No, wait. The Chaos Communication Camp or Chaos Communication Congress ended on the 30th of December. It's now, what, the 11th of January? You're just getting back now?
Yeah, well, Berlin's a great place.
Oh, I know that.
Yeah, so, you know, there are all these hacker spaces and all these geek meetups, and it's just a lot of stuff happening, and I'm really glad I got to spend some time there.
Well, you sure did, but what kinds of things did you see? What did you do? Anything?
Well, of course, I had to do another workshop in Berlin, an ISP and hackerspace there.
Now, Mitch, you say you had to, like, you hate doing this. I don't believe you.
Yeah.
No. I didn't
buy that either.
It was burning within me, and I was asked to do it, so I said yes. And and then I went to an all-night hackathon at Seabase, which was called Break Fast, where you're supposed to break something and then you get to eat breakfast. But
you just have to break something? Because I could do that very easily.
Oh, yeah, you could do it. Anyone can do it. That's what it's all about. So,
I think I might have done it right here tonight, actually. But
yeah, I brought a whole bunch of stuff to play with, but unfortunately I had to leave because they smoked cigarettes. And it was a cloud of smoke and I couldn't breathe.
Well,
but
they are still German, you know.
It's still Germany. Yeah.
Yeah. I see you have a 28C3 T-shirt there.
Proudly sporting.
Hope you brought me one. Behind Enemy Lines, that was the theme this year.
That was the theme, and yeah, so, you know, they have a theme every year, but not many people really stick to it in all the talks or whatever, but I didn't go to many talks this year, but the one I did go to was by Cory Doctorow, and he was really fantastic.
You know, we keep trying to get him to come to Hope.
Yeah,
and
Corey, come on.
There's always some reason why he doesn't come to... Now he's coming to Chaos Camp. I understand he's even going to DEF CON this year, but trying to get him to come to Hope.
Yeah. It usually lands on his birthday.
Well, it can't always because, you know, the dates of Hope change from year to year, so it can't always be his birthday. So if you know, we're going to try doing it in a different month and see if he uses that excuse again. But
well, Corey,
maybe a petition
there,
is in order or something, or some kind of, what do you do in court? We force somebody to do something.
He could probably file some court papers to move his birthday.
Okay.
To a month when we would never have
Or change his name maybe so that it's not his birthday anymore or something like that.
It seems easy enough
change
to
the name of the month, change the number of days in the month. We'll figure something out. We're hackers after all. But okay, but speaking of Hope, which I've deftly moved the conversation towards, tomorrow at noon, the pre-registration officially opens for Hope number 9. And yes, then the horses are on the track at that point. And that's going to be a lot of fun because it's on. It really is on. A lot of people have gotten the pre-registration tickets. Well, a few, not a lot, I would guess. We filled that up pretty quickly. But now it's general admission. Still less than you'll pay at the door. Go to hope.net for more information on that, or hope9.net. Either one of those will work, or 2600.com. This weekend, we're going to have something rather fun happening. You might recall in November, we released the videos for the first Hope in 1994. In December, we released the videos online for Beyond Hope from 1997. Well, this weekend, guess what? We're going to be releasing the videos from H2K from the year 2000, starting on Friday morning, because this conference was the first one that went 3 days. It starts at 10 a.m., and it'll be running until Sunday evening. And hour by hour, just like we've done the last two conferences, we'll be releasing them online. And you can simply click on a couple of buttons and watch the video in the comfort of your own home. And if you want DVD quality, well, there are buttons to hit to get that, too.
Manuel?
Yes?
It doesn't seem like it was that long ago.
It really doesn't. No, it really doesn't. I mean, true, it was pre-9/11, and that seemed like a different age altogether. But no, it doesn't seem that long ago. Mitch, now, was this before you started going to conferences?
It was before I started going to conferences, but there's a lot of it that's very similar because, you know, the world ended on January 1st, 2000.
I was there, yeah.
Yeah, and the world ended at the Maker Faire May 18th, This past year.
Oh, did it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. There were big billboards proclaiming it.
Oh, because of the guy, yeah.
That camp, is that
his Yeah. name?
Camping.
Camping, yeah.
From your part of the world.
Yeah, Oakland. We had a big celebration at the Maker Faire when the world was supposed to
By the way, this is of interest and related to that. His radio station here in the New York area, WFME, I believe, 94.7, it's for sale. Apparently, when you predict the end of the world and it doesn't happen, it costs a lot of money, and now they're looking to unload that station. You can get it here. So if anyone out there is cool and wants to buy a radio station and do something different with it, I understand that one is for sale.
I got $20. Is that enough?
I don't think that's going to be enough, but you know,
I got 20 I can kick.
You might call them. But let's just use this as a barometer to show people that radio stations like WBAI are few and far between. Here we have a station. It's religious now. And it's an opportunity for it to be something different. And what do you want to bet is just going to be the same old crap that we hear everywhere else in, say, a year? Let's just keep an eye on it. 94.7. Let's see what happens.
We could start a religion based around free and open airwaves and raise a lot of money that way. I mean, that's a great way to raise money, right?
There isn't a religion. Buy a radio station.
You're trying to definitely move the you're trying to definitely move the conversation over to starting religions, which okay. It's not so deaf because I have to find that story first. But
well, we can say that this takes place in Sweden, where all kinds of stories like this tend to take place.
That's the assumption that it's taking place in Sweden, of course. Where is that story? So Sweden, which is a country in the northern part of Scandinavia, which is a region of Europe which gets a lot of snow this time of year.
It's in the middle of Scandinavia, really.
Well, okay, it's in the middle if you want to
it's all
be technical
northern.
About
well,
it.
Well, you know, it's north of Denmark.
They speak Swedish there. Okay, and here's a story. Yes.
They also speak English.
The Church of... I can't read
copy
this.
Me.
Too,
copy me.
Here, you read
copy
that.
Copy me, but it's spelled
small.
Funny.
Sometimes you print stories out, and they print in microscopic print, and you just can't read them.
So the Church of Copy Meism, whose principal
of
tenant...
Whoa. What word did you just say? Church of what?
Copy Meism.
Copy Meism? That's a word?
K-O-P-I-M-I-S-M.
You can call your religion whatever you want.
Well, yeah, it would be nice if you could understand what the word means.
Well, it's the church whose principal tenant is the right to file share, and it's been formally recognized as a religious organization in Sweden, whatever
right.
that means.
Well, that's great, and I guess you get all kinds of benefits from that. But what's interesting about this, and I'm going to ask Bernie about this, apparently this is not the first time this particular issue has been religionified, or whatever the word is for that.
Well, I don't know about that particular issue, but back in 2009 at PlumberCon in Austria, which is a great hacker conference.
And a great country, too.
It was all around great, right near MetaLab, which is an awesome hackerspace, MetaLab. There was the Church of Security, which is another church. Now,
tell us about that, because that really sounds interesting, the Church of Security.
Well, it's very good. They handed out buttons and everything. I have one on my backpack. The Church of Security... I mean, I'm not really up on all of their religious dogma, but it seems to have some opposing tenets with the Church of Copymeism. Church of Security would like to secure things and make them private, whereas the Church of Copymeism means that that sharing information is a sacrament. So I would like to see a theological debate between the high priests of these religions.
I'd like to see maybe a crusade or something. I mean, it's been a while, and you know, it's kind of emphatic when you really believe in something.
Crusades, I'm not really into them.
No?
No. Too much death, and then at the end, you have to like really believe things that aren't true to make the death worth
it. You got to have death if you're going to have religion.
It's not worth
it. You can't have one without the other. Why do you think every church has so many cemeteries? Come on. they're tied together.
That's a good question.
Yeah. Go to an atheist building, whatever, wherever they are.
Do you find any
tombstones there? I don't think so.
The ethical culture people might. I'm not sure.
Really?
I don't know.
Okay.
We're going to get so many letters.
We're trying. We don't get enough. Are there atheist graveyards? I don't know
there
of any particular ones. There are always crosses and stars and things like
really,
that. But
it's not really an organization, right, per se. It's just a...
I never thought of that before.
You know. It's like trying to herd cats, trying to get atheists to all agree to one thing, because the whole point is that you don't believe in anything. So,
well, it could be an interesting cemetery, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Anyway, so anything else you'd like to tell us about these two opposing churches, Bernie?
Well, I'm not a theologist, but I would like to learn more about them, and you know, just the fact that a state, you know, a government, a country, legally recognizes sort of a hacker tenet as an official religion, I think is noteworthy.
Well, I think we should invite both of these churches to Hope, which is taking place July 13, 14, and 15, and maybe on the morning of the 15th, which is a Sunday, we can have services in each of these churches. Is that,
we can copy files.
You really think this guy can get a visa to the U.S.?
Why not? What, are we, religious oppression? Is that what we do here now?
Well, so the one thing I like about the U.S. is that we don't officially recognize religions, which is kind of nice. So I guess there's no chance for official recognition here. But it says their sacred symbols are Control-C and Control-V, which are, of course, the keyboard shortcuts for copy and paste.
What about Shift-Insert? Is that also accepted?
Maybe there's a heretic sect that holds that.
Well, that's my interpretation as Shift-Insert, because I just find that easier to hit. And I don't like using the control key except when I need to.
Sounds like you should create your own branch of the religion.
I don't want to split off, but I will if I have to.
Well, you know, if you feel that strongly about it.
All right. And I also, as long as we're on the subject, I also prefer to use the mouse to copy, you know, to scroll down and copy rather than hit Control-C, because Control-C can also do other things to programs, like interrupt them. I'd hate to see those things mixed up.
Well,
you know what I mean, right, Mitch?
No, I totally know what you mean. I kind of like the idea. Well, I don't know what the laws are like in Sweden. In the U.S., if there's an official religion, mm-hmm. then they're officially allowed to break laws that other people can't break because it's not breaking the law because it's sanctioned by the religion.
To a degree.
Yeah, it only happens sometimes. Depends on the law.
If you don't bring your kid to a doctor, you can still get in trouble for that, even if you believe in it, right?
I mean,
you can
still. Oh yeah, Christian Scientists can get brought to trial for that,
right?
But there are churches that claim that certain psychedelics are sacred, and they're allowed to do them.
Peyote.
And if there was a church, a branch of this church in the United States, would that mean that they'd be allowed to break copyright law?
Well, I can answer the question for Sweden. The answer is no. That it and you know, but. Copying files is almost legal in Sweden anyway, so...
Well, now, of course, Sweden also has the Pirate Party, which is something that we're coming to terms with here. I believe there's a Pirate Party USA.
Yeah, but we don't really have third parties in the USA.
I would like to have...
We don't have a second.
I'd like to have hackers on planet Earth be sort of a forum for all these emerging groups that have not yet found their place here in the States. The Church of Copyism, the Church of Security, the Pirate Party. If there's anyone else you think we should invite, email us, oth@2600.com. This is a great opportunity for us to meet all kinds of people from around the planet that have different views on these issues that affect all of us.
Yeah, you know, I've always found Hope a profoundly spiritual experience, and it's nice to sort of codify that now.
Yeah, so I find myself praying to the gods at least once over the weekend that please let this just go without a hitch or something like that. Interesting news. I don't know if people know about this. Maybe if you're listening to 5 o'clock Shadow this afternoon with Robert Knight, you might have heard it. But Zuccotti Park is back, well, back a little bit. They took down the barricades, the metal barricades. Apparently they needed to surround somebody else with them. So they're not there anymore. I just went by Zuccotti, and there's people there. There are mic checks going on. There's people playing music, handing out leaflets. They're not camping, but they're there, and the spirit is back. And since it's springtime, apparently we're not going to have winter this year, a lot of people are there, and it's a good feeling. And, of course, if you walk through the I believe it's the Deutsche Bank building on Wall Street with the public plaza. There are meetings going on inside there, and apparently that's been going on for a while as well. So it's don't believe what you read in the media about all of this being dead or finished. It's not. It's very much alive, and when the weather starts getting better, it's probably going to get even more alive. But it's alive right now, at this very moment.
Are the drummers back?
I didn't see any drummers.
Oh, wow.
You don't like drummers.
Not these drummers.
What's wrong with these drummers?
They're
from the wrong church or something?
Yeah,
or?
Too much.
Well, you know, if you're gonna start beating a drum, you need to beat it loudly. That's my view. Bass and drum are very important that they be throbbing, and you know, you have to hear it at least three blocks away. Otherwise, what's the point?
What religion is this that you belong
this
to?
This is
now?
Just my own personal view. So just wanted to let people know about that, because that's something I just noticed. Now, something you might notice, if you look up in the skies, you might see drones up there. Yes, drones watching you. And the Electronic Frontier Foundation has filed suit against the Federal Aviation Administration seeking information on drone flights in the United States. Now, the FAA is the sole entity within the federal government capable of authorizing domestic drone flights. And for too long now, it has failed to release specific and detailed information on who is authorized to fly drones within U.S. borders. This comes from the EFF.org website. Up until a few years ago, most Americans didn't know much about drones or unmanned aircraft. There are these, in case you don't know, these devices that we use to kill Pakistanis and various other people. I think that's their sole. Well, so far, they're just used to kill people in certain countries. But apparently,
how big is a drone? Does anyone know?
I've never seen one.
Well, they can be just a...
I'm sorry, what's that, Bernie?
They vary in size.
But the ones that kill people, how big are they?
They have to be bigger because they have to carry a bomb, so you need a big wingspan. So fortunately, it's a small drone flying over you. They can't drop bombs.
Okay, all right.
What's the smallest one that could kill me?
Why do you care so much about what kind can kill you?
If it flew into your head, and then I guess it could be a small one.
Well, that kills the drone, too.
You mean the kind that drop bombs? It would probably have to be the size of not much smaller than a small single engine aircraft that, you know, one pilot, like a Piper Cub or something really small like that. It has to be a little bit not much smaller than that to carry, you know, bombs and shoot people. But that's a horrible concept. It's something like that be flying over anybody's head.
Yeah, well, all kinds of unmanned craft have been up there for a while. According to this this release, the U.S. military has been using drones in its various wars and conflicts around the world for more than 15 years, using the Predator drone for the first time in Bosnia in 1995, the Global Hawk drone in Afghanistan in 2001. I believe that we were using drones back in the Vietnam War, too, just to get aerial surveillance. Correct me if I'm wrong on that. I know Israel's been using drones forever, they've been up there. It's only a matter of time before they started using them here against us to spy on Americans, to see what we're up to. We've talked about it on this program when we had people on from Occupy Wall Street. We were talking about putting the robocopters up so that we can see what people are or what police are doing and report back on that. And those are really kind of neat devices. Mitch, have you worked with those, the robocopters?
I haven't worked with them directly, but that was one of the things I saw at my first hacker conference in Berlin, which made me go back again and again and again. Uh-huh. They're really amazing, the videos you can just search for online and see what the police are blocking you from seeing by having a row of riot gear. The little microcopter goes up with a video camera and you can see them tear gassing people. But at Noisebridge, there are people working on microcopters for
this
purpose.
That's the hackerspace in Bay Area?
Yeah, the one that I helped co-found in San Francisco. People at Noisebridge then put out the word, and there are hackerspaces all around the world working on this now for OWS.
Uh-huh. Well, that'd be interesting. You can do all kinds of interesting things with that. Are there safety concerns with having these devices just going up into the air?
Well, that was what I was wondering. Like, if there's going to be now a ruling to stop these drones that hurt people, is there that same ruling going to stop the Occupy people or anyone from sending up ones so that we as people can see what police that we pay for are doing against individuals? According to what I know with the space programs that go on at Noisebridge and other places, if something weighs less than 4 pounds, you technically don't need a approval from the FAA.
Well, otherwise birds would need approval too. Because they're always in space, in that particular space. And these don't – how high up do they go?
I'm not sure how the highest – I think it would be really limited by the radio communications rather than by the propulsion, because it's just by fans.
Uh-huh.
Like computer fans can get pretty powerful.
Well, it would be interesting. Maybe we could launch one at Hope. That would be kind of cool.
That would be way cool.
Yeah. There's all kinds of talk now about doing things in space, you know. We're talking about that at the camp the summer, and I know that was talked about at the Congress as well.
Yeah, just 22 and a half years we have to put a hacker on the moon, according to the predictions there. But
I have a list I'd like to put on the moon. I'm not sure if that's something that they're looking for, but Certainly.
Well, that could help.
Yeah, a few from Mars, too.
But there have been these microcopters at Hope, but only indoors, because Hope is usually indoors.
Usually, yes, but there's no reason why we can't expand it to the rest of the city as well and start launching things. And that sounds really ominous, but no, it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be. Imagine putting one of your TV Begons on a Robocopter and basically just going throughout the city, turning off TVs in people's windows and things like that. That would be fun.
I must admit, the first thing I thought of was a fantasy of having one go up and down skyscrapers and taking just a small visit to each window.
Uh-huh. Wow. Okay, that could be. Or just going amok inside a mall or something, going through one of those stores with 1,000 TV sets on the wall and just sort of visiting and then leaving.
Yeah, or CES in Las Vegas, which just happened. There's probably like 10,000 big screen TVs per square inch there.
Okay, I don't know how we got into the TV guns exactly, but let's go back to the drones. The drones are being used domestically for non-military purposes, raising significant privacy concerns. For example, this past December, U.S. Customs and Border Protection purchased its 9th drone. It uses these drones inside the United States to patrol the U.S. borders, which most would argue is within its agency mandate. But it also uses them to aid state and local police for routine law enforcement purposes. In fact, the Los Angeles Times reported in December that the organization used one of its Predators to roust out cattle rustlers in North Dakota. Yeah, the Times quoted local police as saying they have used 2 unarmed Predators based at Grand Forks Air Force Base to fly at least 2 dozen surveillance flights since June. State and local police are also using their own drones for routine law enforcement activities, from catching drug dealers to finding missing persons. Some within law enforcement have even proposed using drones to record traffic violations. Actually, now, I've seen the signs on highways that say speed controlled by aircraft. I've seen that. So is this really anything new?
Probably not. I've traveled around in the U.S. a great deal back when I had a vehicle, a VW van, for 12 years. And I saw that sign. And quite often I would see airplanes flying over that were, you know, that's what they were doing. They were.
Bernie, did you have something on this?
Well, yeah, for literally for decades, at least in Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania State Police had been flying long stretches of the Pennsylvania Turnpike in coordination with ground vehicles, you know, police cars on the ground and communicating by radio. And they would use a stopwatch. They would time people who would go from, you know, from one line painted across the road to another one. And then they would radio ahead and say, oh, this guy's speeding, pull over the old New York telephone van or whatever they saw. Of course, I don't know if the 2600 van goes past the speed limit. It's so old.
Well, actually, I did get pulled over for speeding once. So it was a school zone. It was nighttime. Okay, there were no school kids out, but whatever.
But I don't think they do that very often. I think they leave the signs up to sort of intimidate people. But I think it's just not cost effective to launch aircraft. At least manned aircraft to do that. But with drones, you know, as these things get lower, you know, less expensive, I really fear our skies filled with these things, surveilling everything we do. It's not really far-fetched. It could happen.
I'm looking forward to Google drones. I'm sure they'll be up there mapping things out and telling us where we are and things like that. Corporations can easily do this as well as military, right? Interesting. All right, well, we have to keep an eye on these things, and good luck to the EFF with pursuing information from the FAA. You have to file these lawsuits. In fact, the only reason Zuccotti Park is open right now is because the ACLU filed a lawsuit to get those barriers taken down, and they succeeded. So it's,
yeah, they didn't even win the lawsuit yet, but they're the ACLU. And for some reason, the New York Police Department listened to
them. The threat of a lawsuit. The threat of yet another lawsuit. So, yeah, sometimes you have to do these things. Okay, and speaking of international intrigue in the skies and angry people firing things at other people, hackers who attack Israel, all right, and I know there's a large number of you out there, so please listen. Hackers who attack Israel need to know they will be attacked back. That's according to Israel's deputy foreign minister, Danny Ayalon. Great name for a foreign minister, Danny. I don't know, just somehow, I would say Daniel, you know, it's a foreign minister, for God's sake, Danny. Anyway, he said this on Saturday, following a cyber attack on Israeli credit card holders earlier in the week. Whoever harms Israel's cyberspace is not immune from retaliation, he told a meeting at a community center in the southern city of Beersheba. Not quite sure why he told them that, but an aide to Ayalon told the Boston Herald that Israel views cyber attacks as acts of terrorism. And viewing it like that, I guess they can do anything in response to an act of terrorism, right?
Emmanuel?
Yes.
How soon do you think it'll be before the Mossad takes out a hacker by attaching a magnetic bomb to their car, like apparently did in Iran the other day with a nuclear scientist?
Yeah, I heard about that. Somebody on a motorcycle went up to this guy's car and attached a magnetic bomb to it and then apparently drove away, and it went off. And, of course, obviously it's not something that the Iranian authorities would do to one of their own nuclear scientists. So somebody who's anti-Iranian nuclear advancement was behind that. So it could very well be the Mossad. And they're denying it, too, which they usually do when they do something. anyway, these comments came after an anti-Israeli activist revealed credit card details and other information on thousands of Israelis, 15,000 last Tuesday, another 11,000 on Thursday. The hacker identified himself as Oksimor, wrote he was a member of the hacker group Anonymous, initially claimed 400,000 Israelis were affected. So does this mean, then, that the Israelis are going to classify Anonymous as a terrorist organization and take all kinds of actions, like lobbing missiles at them and doing all kinds of things from drones and various other tactics, because these are terrorists? We have to deal with terrorists in the ways that we do that. Cyber attacks, after all, you post somebody's credit card numbers, it's the exact same thing as blowing up a cafe. I'm sure we can all agree to that. The details exposed included the credit card numbers, names, addresses, telephone numbers, and identity numbers. An Israeli student, meanwhile, claimed to have uncovered the identity of Oksimor and said he was not from Saudi Arabia, as had been claimed, but was a teenager living in Mexico, but who hailed originally from the United Arab Emirates. Boy, you know, let's get every country involved here. The student said he was able to make the trace after Oksimor used a particular email address to conduct interviews with Israeli media. Well, that's pretty damning right there. If you use a particular email address, must be that person. Anyway, that's interesting chain of events there. You piss off Israel, and who knows what will happen to you. Also, involving Israel as well. Imagine you're a human rights activist working for an NGO in Sri Lanka. After a hard day's work in a humid office building, you walk into your apartment, fire up your laptop, and fire off the following tweet. Holding workshop with LTTE and Sri Lankan government about easing roadblocks for medical supplies to be trucked in. Conference going well, God willing. Congratulations, you're now a terrorist. It sounds like the plot of an action movie, but according to a controversial 2010 ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court, NGOs and those who work on their behalf could be held criminally and civilly liable for providing nonviolent material support to designated terrorist groups. That's right. In Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project, the you know, that's a horrible case to be on the other side of. Holder versus Humanitarian Law Project. The court extended the Patriot Act's prohibition on material support to terrorist groups to include expert advice, assistance, and personnel. Under the contentious 6-3 decision, aiding and abetting the enemy could be as innocent as providing antibiotics to refugees or something like sending out a tweet. The decision already has its shares of detractors. Former President Jimmy Carter and Noam Chomsky have also come out against it, warning that the decision could hamper the work of NGOs around the world, endanger the lives of civilians in war-torn areas, including women and children. Is promoting social justice in Sri Lanka the same as shouting fire in a crowded theater, and one that presumably is not on fire? They say yes. It's interesting. I'm trying to get my head around this as well. This is
I think we covered this case when it happened.
Yeah.
Holder being, of course, the attorney general appointed by President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a frightening decision that anything you say, you don't even necessarily have to be in contact with one of these designated terrorist organizations. But if you say something that helps them, then you can get in trouble.
Now, I said this had to do with Israel. It actually has more to do with the United States because a particular group, Sherat Hadin, is using this decision to sue social media giants such as Twitter, accusing them of violating, get this, U.S. anti-terror laws by hosting the accounts of Hezbollah, al-Shabaab, other terrorist groups. And in a recent interview with the Jerusalem Post, they claim that unless the accounts are deleted, the California-based tech company could face fines, even indictments, maybe even some missiles. Who knows? Because, again, you piss off Israel, and that's the kind of thing that could happen. So it's getting really kind of weird. And I'm how do you verify that a particular Twitter account belongs to Hezbollah anyway? You know?
They probably have a press contact, Hezbollah, that you could call up and ask. But yeah, the crazy thing about this law is it doesn't actually have to be owned by anyone who is on the official list of Hezbollah, you know, whatever. I'm sure they keep detailed records of those sorts of things. But if the account is supporting or deemed to be supporting the actions of an entity that the U.S. government deems to be terrorist, then, according to this legal theory, it could be illegal. And that's really crazy that a tech company would have to determine in advance what accounts fall under this vague law.
We seem to have a theme in 2012 so far of just getting more and more control over things and having to account for every little detail. And it really sort of flies in the face of everything that the net has been about or has supposedly been about from its inception. And, of course, we've been fighting battles ever since it became commercialized and overseen by government forces. Here's something else. This has to do with our good friends who are trying to put out SOPA. Remember SOPA? Yeah, well, first of all, there's going to be a hearing next week, I believe. I'm trying to find the details. I think I've got them someplace. Does anybody have the details with them? There's going to be a hearing a week from today, I believe, in D.C.
January 18th.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
January 18th.
That's a week from today, right?
That's right.
Okay, do you have the details, Bernie, as to where it is?
Yeah, Republican Congressman Daryl Issa, he called a hearing that's going to bring tech industry representatives to Washington to really talk about how this Stop Online Piracy Act could effectively break the internet. As we discussed on the show three weeks ago, there were hearings about this legislation where tech industry representatives, aside from like one person from Google, were not really allowed to comment, or their comments were just like summarily dismissed as like they didn't mean anything. And we're really talking about it from very serious abilities. Maybe Mike has some more technical details, but it affects the domain name system, DNS, and it really puts in private hands the ability to shut down any website that might have content that company doesn't like or says might infringe on their copyrights. Do you have anything more on that, Mike?
So I'm glad to hear that people who actually understand how the internet works will be talking to Congress. Not that I'm much of a believer that Congress will listen. But, you know, it's still not quite right. I want Congress to be told, this bill doesn't just prevent me from making a profit. This bill prevents me from speaking my mind in the public forum of the 21st century. And that should be reason enough for Congress to reject this bill. And they're not even listening to that argument, and that really concerns me.
It's First Amendment stuff.
Yeah, well, I was talking to, I guess I won't name names, a very well-known American security expert in Berlin after Congress, and he was brought in to an emergency phone call set up by Google with the ex-head of the NSA, whose name I can't recall at the moment.
It's a secret.
I don't think he's keeping his name a secret, but I'm bad with names. And anyways, this guy is actually, according to this well-known American security expert, actually understands security. This does indeed break the ability for the internet to be secure. And this ex-head of the NSA is very concerned that even though it allows the government to snoop, et cetera, it makes it so that the government will no longer have security and corporations will no longer have security. And this might be the thing that could stop SOPA. Incidentally, the same person said that in his experience with lobbying in D.C., if you say anything about civil liberties or if you bring up anything about the Constitution, you're immediately discounted, and anything you say after that is not as valid as it might have been before.
I'm well aware of this effect, but it doesn't make it stop bothering me.
No, it bothers me a great deal. But it is interesting that we can take, we collectively, including the ex-head of the NSA, can take this tack that on security grounds alone, SOPA is very bad.
All right, this comes from our friends over at Torrent Freak. On a leaked letter sent to Spain's outgoing president, the U.S. ambassador to the country warned that as punishment for not passing a SOPA-style file-sharing site blocking a SOPA-style file-sharing site blocking law. Wow. Spain risks being put on a United States trade blacklist. Inclusion would have left Spain open to a range of retaliatory options, but already the U.S. was working with the incoming government to reach its goals. United States government interference in Spain's intellectual property laws had long been suspected, but it was revelations from WikiLeaks that finally confirmed the depth of its involvement. More than 100 leaked cables show that the U.S. had helped draft new Spanish copyright legislation and had heavily influenced the decisions of both the government and opposition. So it's not just here that the U.S. is pushing this. It's in countries all over the world. And if it doesn't work here, we're going to try and make it work somewhere else and then bring it back here. That's how our government works.
Yeah, it's this really clever tactic that the copyright industry uses where they get some terrible law passed in country A, and then they say to country B, hey, look, we got to harmonize our laws with country A. But what they do is they just make the law slightly more repressive than it was in country A. And then, you know, the first country has to go back and harmonize with the second country. And it's just this mad dash to the most repressive copyright laws possible. And it's clever. I admire their cleverness, but it's really disturbing in all other respects.
All right. Any other words on SOPA, Rob? No?
Nope.
Okay, I thought you were waving.
No.
All right. Bernie, anything else you want to share with people?
I just want to say I also find it disturbing that our government is our State Department is apparently bought and paid for by the intellectual copyright industry, intellectual property industry, and is really using egregious strong-arm tactics against other countries like Spain to force them to enact legislation like that we have in this country. And it's really, you know, if it weren't for organizations like WikiLeaks and Cryptome and other organizations that publish, leaked back-channel communications about what our government is really doing around the world, we wouldn't even know about this.
Yeah, I would like to ask if we have any listeners in Spain, which I think we may. Tell us what it's like there and how the reaction to this is going on, because I know if I were a citizen of a country and another country was found to be dictating my laws, I would be rather pissed.
All right. Our phone number, by the way, is 212-209-2900. We'll be taking phone calls in just a couple of minutes. And of course, if you're outside the country, our country code is 1 because we grabbed it before anybody else got it.
I just want to say is that as terrible as the U.S. government's involvement in all this is and the U.S. Copyright industry's involvement, still, they're talking to people in Spain, and the people in Spain are saying, yeah, okay, and they certainly deserve some of the blame here.
Yes, absolutely. Speaking of SOPA, there's a web-based civic action site. They're providing a way for people who are irate about the Stop Online Piracy Act to voice their opinions in a very literal way. Reverse Robocall is a site set up by Sean Dakin and Aaron Titus. They allow users to record a message through the site and perform their own robocalls to politicians and lobbyists. For a fee of $10, Reverse Robocall will let you record a message that will be delivered as a phone call to the offices of the co-sponsors of SOPA and each of the associations and lobbying groups that have backed the bill in Congress, 88 of them in all. You can customize the phone number that will appear and caller ID for the call in order to avoid being blocked by systems that reject calls without them. And if you choose, you can let others listen in on your message on the site and rate your effort. Seems to me you could probably do this for a lot less than $10. You could probably do it yourself, right, Mitch?
Yeah, as far as I know, if you have a plan on your phone or your cell phone, you can make a call for no additional charge at all.
Yeah, but it's good that people are getting out there. But I guess people are going to try and make money off this.
Well, I mean, the brilliant thing about this site is that it reverses the normal pattern, which is that the politicians call you at home and tell you to vote for them without ever expending any of their actual human time.
Well, that's okay.
But the advantage of being a human being is that you probably actually do have 5 minutes to actually make the phone call yourself and talk to the person on the other end.
Right.
And I would advise using those 5 minutes.
Now, my question, Bernie, maybe you know the answer to this. I know that you can add yourself to the do not call list as many times as you want, but it doesn't get you out of getting those stupid political ads that are relentless in calling you and saying, vote for me, et cetera, et cetera. Well, does the same contract work in the other way? Can you relentlessly call politicians and say, "Pay attention to me. I'm one of your subjects here."
The do not call laws exempt political phone calls, so it doesn't specify whether they have to be from political candidates. So I would say that you're exempt if you use the service or personally call anyone. I mean, I guess it wouldn't even apply if you're calling in person because the do not call list really, I think, well, no, it would apply. So basically, you're exempt. If it's political speech, if you're calling anybody who's on the do not call list, you're still allowed to call them for political reasons.
Okay, good to know. Also, one more SOPA item. In protest of the Stop Online Piracy Act and the Protect IP Act, a nefarious act that tries to censor the internet world, or actually the internet without actually showing much understanding of said internet in the first place, comes from a site known as Geek System. Reddit, one of the most popular social news aggregation sites currently on the very same internet, will black itself out next week. Redditors may not know what to do with themselves, but on January 18th, which is a week from today, from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Reddit will be blacked out in protest. Instead of the normal Reddit feed, the site will display a simple message regarding how the SOPA and PIPA legislation would shut down sites like Reddit itself. So that's something I guess a lot of entities are getting involved with this. It's good to see.
Yeah, there's a lot of people putting like black banners on their sites and pop-ups and all kinds of things.
Okay, go ahead, Rob.
Yeah, and that's going to be key to doing any sort of making any sort of headway with this issue at all, because people like us know what's what. People like most of our listeners, I think, have a pretty good idea of what's what. But it's about telling everybody else. It's about telling the general public and getting them on your side and explaining to them directly what effect this would have on them.
Okay, there's one more story that I really like to just focus on, then we'll take some phone calls, 212-209-2900, and that's our friends, all of whom have been on the show at one point, talking about Birgitta Johnsdottir, Jacob Applebaum, Rob Hochrieb. They have all lost a case, lost an appeal concerning our government, trying to obtain their Twitter records. This is all in connection to their support of the WikiLeaks site. Now, I haven't had much time to go through this court documents. It's 3 pages long, but it just seems like the court is rejecting their concerns. Does anybody have a chance to look at this more carefully? No?
What? Yeah, so I don't know the details of what you have in your hands, but I do know that the only reason we know about Google and Jake Applebaum's internet service provider being forced to hand over information about his email headers to the government is because it was leaked to the Wall Street Journal. And it was a gag rule, so no one would have known. These entities were forced to give over the information. They were also forced to be unable to tell Jake that it even happened, which is very disturbing.
Yeah, Jake's ISP, Sonic, was nice enough to actually try and fight the court order, spent a good deal of their own money on lawyers unsuccessfully, but at least they tried. Companies like Google did not even try.
Well, Twitter tried too, right?
Twitter tried, yes.
Yeah, and yeah. I think that's how we learned about this in the first place, about a year ago.
So, this new news pertains specifically to Federal Magistrate Judge Buchanan's December 14th, 2010 order directing Twitter to disclose records, their records of these four people that we mentioned who are in support of WikiLeaks. And
three people. I don't know who the fourth person is.
It says there were four individuals.
Jacob, Brigida, and Rob. Who's the fourth? Is it one of us?
Maybe that person is secret.
Okay. I mean, it's probably Julian. I'm sure he's in there somewhere, too.
That could well be the case. So in any case, it would take too long to cover this on the air, but you can look up, just email us at oth@2600.com, and we will send you the decision. A federal judge ruled that their appeal, saying we should have our privacy, that our Twitter record should not be exposed to the federal government, was invalid.
Okay, and one final story, then we'll take some phone calls, 212-209-2900. This week, tomorrow, the long-awaited opening of a new realm of web addresses in which just about any word, such as .dot furniture or .dot arctic vacations, can serve as a domain name. .dot hackers, I guess, can be a top-level domain now. To some, that spells opportunity. Beginning tomorrow, the organization that oversees the Internet, that would be ICANN, I believe, will start accepting applications to manage new top-level domains, names that appear at the end of website addresses like .com and .net. It'll be the first time in more than a decade that anyone can apply for the rights to control a slice of the broader web marketplace, as opposed to just domains for specific types of Internet users. Only a few options, such as .jobs for sites catering to job seekers, have been available more recently. Now, of course, not just anybody can do this. You have to basically be prepared to act as a registrar, and the fee is kind of hefty. I'm looking for the actual number here, but I think it's something like it's a $185,000 application fee, and I'm pretty sure none of us have that lying around.
That doesn't even guarantee that you get the top-level domain. I think that's, you know, the application.
Well, do you get your money back if you don't?
No, you don't.
Well, how do I run an organization like that where I can collect a $185,000 fee and not even give something to somebody?
I would like to know, actually, how ICANN continues to be in charge and what they're going to do with all this money.
Because, Mike, they have a positive attitude. I can, not I can't, which seems to be your attitude. All right, let's take some phone calls. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up, please.
Yes.
Hi.
Annoying buzz is gone.
It's gone, yes.
Nice signal.
Yes, please don't replace it with anything more annoying. What's on your mind?
I wanted to talk more about the possibility of these Twitter users who are classified as terrorists actually coming up against this new defense authorization where people can be held without trial or anything.
Oh, there's all kinds of combinations that can be used now. The Patriot Act, the defense, that new defense thing, the classifying people as terrorists.
Yeah, I mean, let's be clear that the people in question here are people like Hezbollah who the U.S. government already doesn't like. It's just a question of what new powers the U.S. government might get to block anyone in the United States who ever repeats anything they might have said.
But then who becomes an enemy of Israel if you express an opinion, you know, disagreeing with something like these embargoes of ships they bring in, et cetera, to coming to Gaza?
I think we all start off as by default as enemies of Israel, and we have to prove that we're not. Otherwise, we could have a missile lobbed at us. That's just the way I look at things and how I get through the day. All right, good evening. You're on Off the Hook. Speak up.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Made that quickly. All right, you mentioned the top-level domain jobs, and it occurs to me. Well, I've been concerned about what the job, you know, everybody's misty-eyed about Steve Jobs these days. It brings my mind to Apple.
Uh-huh.
You know the company Foxconn or something like that in China, and it's like apparently everything physical that comes out of that company is going through this hellish operation. And I'm just wondering, like, does Apple, Macintosh, whatever you call it, have to basically be blacklisted by decent people because of what they're doing to their workforce?
So let's be clear that, like, all consumer electronics are made in factories like the ones that Foxconn runs. But if you'd like to know more about or substantially all.
I think Mitch disagrees with you on that.
But let me finish my thought, which is that the radio program This American Life just this past weekend did a very nice piece on the conditions in these factories, and you should give it a listen.
Yeah, so, you know, it's definitely not the case that all places are as bad as Foxconn. You can, as an individual, go to places and interview them and check out their conditions. Some are actually quite good. Some are quite bad. And
you've done that in China, right?
I go there every year. And before I even chose one to manufacture TV Gone, I went there and interviewed them. Some that said they were good were not. And the difference in price per unit between a place that's a black hole of despair and one that treats their employees well and pays them well and even gives them their own chef for what they want to eat for lunch is 25 cents. 25 cents between the difference of making the world an incredibly wretched place for so many people and actually doing something right.
And also, let's be clear that Foxconn doesn't work solely with Apple. They work with a number of companies. Microsoft uses them to manufacture their gaming consoles. And I'm sure there are other major companies that work with them too. So it's not just limited to Apple.
No, they're just a bad, egregious example. Yeah. But please research.
But as bad as Apple is, and it pains me to really say anything nice about the company, I don't think they're that much worse than any of the other consumer electronics companies. Very few of these companies care about the people who make their products.
Yeah, which is very unfortunate because we can. And, you know, the difference between a quarter per unit, I mean, what is – but when a corporation exists for maximizing their profits every quarter – what can you do?
You know, this brings up very what Mike said rings true because there's an incredible film I think you all should see if you haven't seen it already called Blood in the Mobile. It's all about how mobile phones are made and how people in Africa are victimized to gain the minerals necessary that are used in the production of electronics, basically, Nokia is targeted in this particular film because that happens to be the phone company of the filmmaker, and he wants to find out from his phone company. He considers it his phone company, as many of us consider the phone company we use to be our phone company. He wanted to get some kind of statement from them. Now, other companies are just as bad. So yes, just like Microsoft might be just as bad as Apple. They don't really care, and that's I think what comes out in this film. I really recommend it. It's made by a Danish documentary maker. Saw it at the Hampton Film Festival this fall, and hopefully we can show it at Hope as well. Also on the subject of Steve Jobs, this is a story Jim handed to us right before the show. Apparently, there's a Steve Jobs action figure that's out now, and wow, this really looks realistic.
Where, Emmanuel, is this action figure manufactured?
I don't know if it tells you where, but probably somewhere where people are victimized. I'm sure it's a 12-inch tall action figure. It's remarkably realistic, except for the hands. They look kind of creepy. It's a plastic tribute to the late Apple co-founder. Comes equipped with Steve Jobs' trademark turtleneck and jeans, and will be available in February for about $100. But act fast. Not only are Apple cultists likely to snap these up like the latest iPhone and turn them into rare collector's items, the Hong Kong company, okay, I guess that tells you, that makes the doll reportedly doesn't have permission from Steve Jobs' estate to license his name or image. So that's going to be a spirited debate in court, I would imagine.
Yeah, I don't think it's really worth buying anyway because there'll probably just be a better version of the action figure coming out next year. But,
yeah, this will be obsolete in no time.
There's one other story that I'd like to mention really quick if I could. I just got wind of this right before the show. There's a guy called Chris Fenton from NYC Resistor, the local hackerspace, and he has got hold of a backup disk for the Cray operating system for the old Cray supercomputers, and this operating system was thought lost. It dates back to the 70s. And he built himself a homebrewed disk reader to make a copy of the disk, and now our friend Jason Scott and the Internet Archive are hosting a copy. And what he needs the help of anyone out there, and I'm sure there are a bunch of you out there who could take a look at this disk image, reverse engineer it, and actually get to the files of this ancient operating system. And so if you can help with this, go to nycresistor.com and look for the post dated January 9th.
The end goal of this is that he has a 1/10 scale equivalent version of the Cray itself, you know, hardware equivalent. So if they could get the disk image, the files off the disk image, he could actually run the system again, which that was the whole point. He had built this scale replica but didn't have software. Now he has the image of the software, but still it's not, he can't run it yet. So
complete with the bench?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've got a picture of
it's got here. The bench.
Awesome.
All right, let's throw the picture around. We're gonna take one more phone call in the time that we have left. Good evening. You're on Off the Hook.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Oh, hi. Yeah. My question is, I like, you know, that you report on what has gone on down at Liberty Square. And I'm wondering if, you know, the people, the hackers, have any information on the miking of the park itself, you know, to pick up conversation. Someone told me, in fact, that they thought that the police had done that. And I just wanted to know if you, if anybody on your show can comment about that kind of technology and how it can be detected and revealed.
The thing I'd love to say about that, I don't know in particular if it's being mic'd or not, but I love the fact that people are worried about the police seeing and hearing what goes on at Zuccotti, because in general, the protesters are there to be seen and heard.
Right.
So, you know, nobody's keeping any secrets, I think, in this public park. I think they want people to hear what they're saying.
Yeah, if you're in a public park or public area, you're going to be seen, you're going to be heard, and you should be seen and heard. All right, that's going to just about do it as the personal computer people come in here. We're out of time. Write to us, oth@2600.com. Remember, Hope Number 9 tickets go on sale tomorrow, starting at noon. And we'll have more information on that. Hope.net. We'll see you next week. Have a good night.
Stamp your feet and clap your hand.
We're the slaves of freedom.
Somewhere there's a promised land.
We're the slaves of freedom.
Where we can do what we like.
Aha! That's right. Love that show. 2600 off the hook. But now it's 8 o'clock at WBAI New York 99.5 Wednesday. 1-1-1-2012. And because it's 8 o'clock, you know what that means? It's time for the personal computer shoe. And we've got Joe, we've got Hank, and we're looking for Dave out there on the west. Joe? Joe.
And good evening, good evening, good evening, one and all. This is Joe King, and
hey.
I'm talking to you from high above downtown, wherever I am.
Joe, good to see you there. And this is Hank Key. I'm in the studio with Stevie DB. Welcome all to the Personal Computer Show. And how's that tequila tasting with your foot on the ottoman?
I don't treat my Turkish friends that way. I don't put my feet on them.
No. You know what I'm talking about. You know, I understand that you have a slight cold, and your treatment of the cold is tequila.
No, my treatment of a cold is Irish whiskey. It's a never, never fail cure, Hank. What you do is you roll yourself up in a blanket, and you put a fedora on your foot, and you start sipping the Irish whiskey. And when you see two fedoras, you're either cured or you just don't give a damn.
Wait a minute. What happened to chicken soup?
That doesn't go good with fedoras. David Perry is our West Coast co-host.
Yeah, we're waiting for him to call in because I understand he's traveling by car, and as soon as we get him, we're going to put him on the air, okay?
Yeah, he's out at that fabulous place called
Las Vegas.
Lost Wages, Nevada.
You call it Lost Wages.
You know, I know somebody that went to Las Vegas with a $50,000 car and came
back. And they came back with a $250,000 bus.
There you go.
Hey, Joe, you know, prior to getting on the show and while we're waiting for David, I said to Stevie, did you get the material I sent you? He says,
yeah, I got it.
He got it. I said, do you read it? And he looked at me sheepishly, said, no.
Sheepishly.
Yeah, sheepishly. Because think interests him a lot, okay? And he didn't realize that it was part of the news.
Well, actually,
Flight Simulator?
You know, it's interesting because he's the only one I know who would really profit from that news item.
Well, let me just tell people what it is. Microsoft right now is releasing a beta, and they'll be releasing it as a full version, a free version of the game Flight Simulator. They're going to just call it simply Flight. And the beta version is available for download right now.
Wait a minute. It's no longer a simulator?
Well, they're calling it Flight, and the reason why they're calling it Flight is that they've made some modifications to it, okay?
It's more limited.
Well, first of all, they say it needs a 10-gig hard drive space. You need a dual-core 2-gig processor. I think they're deliberately saying you need a higher-end equipment. You need Windows XP with SP3 and at least 2 gig of RAM. That's a lot. And by the way, Stevie, what the heck is an Icon flying boat?
Icon
A5 flying boat. In other words, this version that they're giving away free has just one airplane in it called Icon A5 flying boat.
I think it's more than one. I think it's three.
No. They're giving the free version is that. But if you join the Windows Live user group, you can get all the extra missions, you can get all the airports, you can get all the other planes if you just sign in.
The graphics are great.
And I didn't realize that they have in their storage 24,000 different airports. Wow. I mean, that's virtually all the airports in the world with 24 different planes. So,
Stevie, you are a flight simulator type person.
Love it.
Well, he's right now. I think he's there's someone paging him, and you know, we're going to interrupt this flight simulation discussion because we now have David on the air.
Hey,
hi,
David. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing really good. And how about all of you?
Listen,
Hank. I would like to point out to our audience that David is actually driving out in the desert right now in downtown fabulous Las Vegas, and he's going to be with us just for a couple of minutes because we're liable to lose his signal at any second. David, what's happening out at CES? What's new and exciting?
Well, there's a huge crowd of people here, and the big news, as Hank has been telling us for a while now, is the Ultrabook. I saw three or four of them. I can tell you what they resemble exactly in every aspect. Ultrabooks are the Windows version of the MacBook Air.
The MacBook Air has been around for a couple of years now.
Yes, but that's what they are. They're a Wintel response to the MacBook Air. They're thin, they're light, and every single one of them that I saw.
Well, I don't know about light.
Had a brushed metal cover that greatly resembled the MacBook Air.
Well, the specs that Intel gave was that to qualify as an ultrabook, it has to have a solid state drive. It has to be 0.8 inch in thickness or lower, and it has to be under 4 pounds in weight.
That sounds like a MacBook Air to me.
Wait. And they had a fourth requirement. It has to have an Intel dual-core processor.
No, it had a fifth requirement, And that's the speed of what its boot-up time is.
Well, in other words, yeah, what it is that you put it in hibernate mode so that you don't have to worry about the boot-up because of the solid-state drive. And you know what? And wait, they actually have another requirement, which is $1,000 or less, and that's a tough one to break.
David, you've actually seen them, and I'm going to ask you the question that I'm always asked. Would you buy one for yourself?
No, I actually like a larger notebook. I'm a very unusual notebook user. I'm a business traveler, which is, I think, a whole big category of users. So I'm not actually carrying it anywhere. I'm, you know, in a case, wheeling it into my hotel room, and then it becomes my office while I'm on the road.
Right.
Well, that's
now, I'm in between notebooks right now. So I just did a business trip with nothing but my iPad. And I want a notebook, please.
Well, you don't think that the iPad or the tablet format is a good replacement for a notebook?
I do not if you have to answer a lot of email.
Yes.
You don't like the virtual keyboard?
Virtual keyboard is not good for a lot of email. And in fact, I'm even upsizing. I'm going to go back to a 15-inch screen on my next notebook.
You know,
I know all the rage is for the 12-inch screen,
yeah,
the X220 and everything.
Well, are any of the Ultrabooks of 14 or 15?
I really don't think I need an Ultrabook.
No, Joe, the Ultrabooks, I find that many of them are 13 or 14-inch.
Yeah.
Okay. By the way, Joe, one of the things was that you sent me a message. I had to call you, and you said, well, you were using your smartphone, and I said that what you said Dave Perry was going to give a Berthold report, and I said, what the heck is that? It's because it's very difficult fingering and keying in input.
Well, it's even worse when you've got autocorrect like you do on the iPhone.
Well, you know, I sent Hank an email the other day from my smartphone, and I didn't realize, yes, I did have autocorrect on it, and I should have read it before I pressed the send button. Because it auto-corrected some words into things that I have no idea what I wrote.
And you know what the irony was? Our general manager, his name is Berthold, and when he said that Dave Perry is going to give a Berthold report, I says, what?
But I had tried to type in, was a cell phone report, and it recorrected it to Berthold without the D on the end.
What else
That's
is new?
That's the first time I've ever heard of auto-correct inserting. There's a lot of stuff for mobility. There is a lot. I saw a product that actually allowed you to tie, and this was from one of the big anti-radar companies, and they had a product that allowed you that you put a radar sensor on your car, and it would talk to your smartphone, and then it would talk to another smartphone that was linked to your smartphone and their radar detector, and you would tell them if there was a radar car approaching them. Which I thought, that's kind of a rarified situation, don't you think?
Yeah. My concern is, if you should ask some of these vendors, with all that distraction, could it impede safety while you're driving a car?
Well, no more than, I mean, you have two people staring at their cell phones to see where the radar detector's on the other guy, you think?
Yeah, that could be a problem.
It doesn't sound like a very safe situation at all to me. But and then there was a lot of people making waterproofing materials for iPhones and iPads for that expanding underwater tablet market.
Underwater tablet market? Why would someone need a computing device underwater?
Well, no, they don't.
Hank, I always get my email when I'm underwater.
Okay.
Or upside down, for that matter. That would be an inversion.
David, what is the big talk out at CES this year? What are people either complaining about or happy about or whatever?
People are complaining that there is nothing really new, but they've been complaining about that since the Comdex of 1987. Because there really is a lot of things. There are dramatic improvements in digital cameras. There are pocket cameras that are 14 megapixel, you know, and all of the phones now have good enough cameras that for most people, a phone is the only camera you need. I saw some really amazing, I'm very much into amazing gizmos and gadgets. And there was an anamorphic split lens that you would stick on the back of your iPhone